A while ago, I put out a question on LinkedIn, you know, asking, hey, if all of your security technologies quadrupled in cost, you know, what would you prioritize? And what I didn't expect to happen happened. And it was an overwhelming majority of people saying, oh, security awareness training. And it's like, it really kind of caught me off guard, right? And because I think it's common for people to say that the human is the weakest link in security, right? And it's true, right? You know, it's and it's might be a freebie for anyone that like wants to sound smart in cybersecurity, but it's like there's an overemphasis that, well, if it's the weakest link, we have to put all of our resources into making that better, right? But here's the thing that I get stuck on. If it's the weakest link, and we're putting more and more resources into that, it's still going to be the weakest link because it's human, right? So it's like we almost have a paradox here where it's just like, well, like security awareness is the most important thing because humans are the weakest link, but humans will continue to be the weakest link. So why are we going to put so much emphasis on that?
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Welcome to the show, Jason. Pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Anthony.
Cool. I'd like to kick off the interview with just asking you some questions about yourself and your team and your company, et cetera. Jump into some thought leadership and then a few closing questions I love to ask folks before we end the interview. Perfect. So, all right. We'll get started. So tell me about yourself, your team, your company, you know, anything along those lines.
Yeah. So for me, I always tell people that I was born and raised in incident response. I spent over a decade responding to all different types of hacks, whether it was nation states threats, whether it was hacktivists. I did a lot in financial crime. After all of that time in incident response, needed a different type of challenge. And so my current role, I'm the CISO over at Corvus Insurance, and I have a little bit of a unique role for what you would think a CISO does. So I obviously do own internal security and spend quite a bit of time there, but I also own our threat intel team. And how are we looking at threats, not only to protect Corvus, but more importantly, how do we protect our policyholders and support all of the underwriters and our data science team? And so we place a pretty heavy emphasis on the threat intel side. I also work with our what we call our risk and response team. This is really around bringing cyber technical expertise at the at our hands to support our underwriters, to support our policyholders, and brokers as well. And then it's also just, you know, almost I always like to think of it as like customer success for our policyholders. How can we make sure that they're successful in using our technology and also just, you know, working through their security program? And then lastly, I do a lot on the product side. So I work with our policyholder experience where, you know, we're really focused on how do we build a platform that our policyholders can access to really get a data-driven experience on understanding what are the important security controls and, you know, trying to take a bigger step forward into quantifying security risk.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like a pretty varied role. Like you said,
yeah, it keeps things interesting. That's how I like it, though.
That's pretty cool. Maybe we'll jump into some of the other stuff you talked about just now in terms of your role. But in terms of maybe Corvus as a company, you know, what kind of geographies are you focused on, and what size of clients do you look at?
Yeah, so we predominantly focus in the mid-market. It's really our sweet spot. You know, we do a little bit on the SMB side. Currently, we write up to $2 billion in revenue. So we've got a good spread. But what we find is that, you know, using the technology that we have, which is scanning technology that brings in more data points to assess the risk of an organization and really just predict the likelihood of an attack happening, we find that we can get that in the underwriter's hand and give them better tools. And so, you know, it's not, I would say it's less about the automation side and more about how do we make our underwriters cyborgs, right? So that they can get all the right technical information and just do what they do best, which is underwriting. And so from a geography standpoint, we do a lot in the US, but recently launched in Germany. And then we have we do a lot of excess business in the UK as well.
Okay, great. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. I a lot of people are talking about Germany lately, I guess, you know, different insurers moving into that market.
Yeah, it seems to be kind of the next hot market.
After the UK, I guess, you know, it's, yep. It's interesting to see.
It seems like there's just some stepping stones that all, you know, carriers are going through to just kind of work their way across the globe.
It is interesting. I know from our side, you know, we start to see companies kind of jumping over, you know, and setting up shop in the UK and mm-hmm. thinking, all right, we're in Europe now. It's like, this is maybe a little trickier than you think it's going to be. So for us, kind of looking at different countries, and it is an interesting one. Like, you know, we went the other direction when we went into the US and in Canada, but at least it was a market that I knew pretty well. You know,
I think. Yeah. Well, I think you have to have that experience too, right? Because, you know, if I put my IR service provider hat on again, you know, it's, you have like this, I think a lot of companies, defer companies, just they have this preconception that, well, listen, attacks are the same, right? You know, whether it's in the US, the UK, Germany, wherever, right? And, you know, to some extent, that's correct, right? But we tend to forget that you're also working for a company, right? This isn't just about chasing the bad guys. It's, you know, understanding what are the local norms, like how do you properly communicate? And when you can't get that right, you know, tailored to that, the individual company, it just does a disservice for those organizations. So I always see that there has to be, or should be at least, a heavy investment in understanding the local culture and getting people who are familiar with that. Because at the end of the day, like is it a tech problem? Yeah, 100%, right? Somebody hacked into your systems. You got to get them back up and running. If it's ransomware, whatever, but you're still working with people to get that done. And so you've got to have that human element coincide with the technical expertise.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. So I guess last of the kind of intro questions, what would you consider your company's strength in cyber?
So I would say it's really around the underwriting prowess that we have, right? You know, this is where we do a really good job of blending in the underwriting expertise with the threat intelligence, with the data science aspect. And so when you can get a really good blend of the technology and the underwriting and just get them into a system where it's just like you can really play off of the strengths of each side, right? You know, underwriters with really assessing the risk and, you know, building the relationships and the technology to just drive better insights. You know, for Corvus, like that is, it's a secret sauce, right? And it seems super, super simple, right? But it's years and years and years of effort and focus to really get it down to the point where it's just, you do play off each other seamlessly versus, you know, what I see is that, you know, some of the legacy carriers might go all in on the underwriting, right? It's a tried and true method, right? But they're also leaving a lot on the table there. Or you have other MGAs that will overcompensate and just go pure tech, right? And so this is like, let's play it down the middle, take the strengths of both sides and, you know, really, really do some good there.
Okay. Interesting. So, you know, probably the sweet spot between the tech and underwriting capabilities is where you see it. So cool. I guess, you know, let's kind of jump into some of the security topics then, you know, I think you've probably seen a lot of really interesting stuff just being able to bounce around in all these different areas of, you know, technical cyber insurance, plus obviously your previous history in DFIR companies. You know, let me start with, you know, maybe phishing and compromises and, you know, how a lot of these things start. You know, the answer, we always just look at the answer as being security awareness training, you know, let's just give everybody security awareness training, and that'll solve it, you know, because people are being tricked to put their passwords in. Right. And that's how, you know, at least business email compromise is happening a lot, you know, other things as well, but, you know, terms of security awareness training, what do you think is lacking?
You're triggering me here. It's interesting because a while ago I put out a question on LinkedIn, you know, asking, hey, if all of your security technologies quadrupled in cost, You know, what would you prioritize? And what I didn't expect to happen happened. And it was an overwhelming majority of people saying, oh, security awareness training. And it's like, it really kind of caught me off guard.
Okay.
Right. And because it, I think it's common for people to say that the human is the weakest link in security. Right. And it's true. Right. You know, it's and it's might be a freebie for anyone that like wants to sound smart in cybersecurity. But it's like there's an overemphasis that, well, if it's the weakest link, we have to put all of our resources into making that better. Right. But here's the thing that I get stuck on. If it's the weakest link and we're putting more and more resources into that, it's still going to be the weakest link because it's human. Right. So it's like we almost have a paradox here where it's just like, well, like security awareness is the most important thing because humans are the weakest link, but humans will continue to be the weakest link. So why are we going to put so much emphasis on that? And so, you know, I always subscribe to the philosophy of defense in depth. Right. Yeah. You know, any company should be assuming that a human is eventually going to mess up, right? And you know, the other, you know, security favorite sayings is it only takes one user. And it's true, right?
Right.
So, you know, if you're going to do a security awareness program training, and you absolutely should, this is not me saying don't go and do this, right?
Right.
But it's understand that this is not where you're, if you're going to spend a dollar, don't spend 90 cents on security awareness training, right?
Yeah.
Do it. Find something that's cost effective, but really focus in on what happens when the inevitable user clicks on a link and, you know, sends off their credentials or installs malware on the system, right? Like I want to focus on how do I put a little bit of backstop there to help mitigate when the eventual thing is going to happen.
Okay. So yeah, it makes sense. I think the you know, defense in depth, I always used to push, you know, awareness training plus, you know, multi-factor, for example, you know, makes
exactly
a difference.
Yeah. Right. And like, if I had to choose between multi-factor authentication and security awareness, MFA all day, like it's not even, like, there's zero thought for me that would go into that because that we know is going to better protect you than somebody just being aware of the threat, right? Like it's like driving. We all know the rules of driving. We all know how to be a safe driver in practice, but some people do it. But there's always that one person who's just speeding down the highway, weaving in and out of traffic, right? And that's the person that's going to cause an accident, right? And so that's where it's just like, okay, well, we can continue to invest in driver safety training, right? And maybe we make it harder to get a driver's license. Or let's put some airbags in there. Let's make sure that, you know, it's requiring seatbelts, right? Like that's the defense in depth that we see in the physical world.
Yeah. Automotive is an interesting sort of template for maybe how, you know, cybersecurity, you know, could be looked at. Cause it is kind of like you say, it's an accident, it's a car crash, you know, so it's, you know, how do you prevent the accidents? It's sort of helping the driver, you know, be aware of what's going on around them. You know, or it's, you know, anti-lock brakes to help them, you know, sort of avoid the accident, that sort of thing as well. But it's also, you know, better airbags, better crumple zones. So it's kind of, that's the resilience piece of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. Well, cool. Well, I guess, you know, talking about some of these tools then, you know, what are, do you have any examples of things that you either really like, you know, you really think everybody should have, or maybe, as well, I'd like to get the other side of that, which is ones that everybody thinks they should have or that they often have, but maybe don't do that much of a difference, make that much of a difference.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because this I feel is like is one of the biggest struggles in security, where we all think that a tool is going to solve our problems, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've seen a tool ever where it's like I buy the tool, I power it up, and then I'm secure. Right. It's just not the reality. Right. And it's part of that is because security is complicated and you really have to kind of tailor it to your environment. Right. So there's a configuration standpoint that has to happen with all of these tools to make sure that they're effective. But, you know, if I'm speaking broadly, right, and I'm looking at all these different attacks that are out there, you know, I try to look at it as, you know, what are the root causes of these attacks, right? You mentioned before with phishing, right? That's, you know, one of the main ways that attackers are stealing credentials. It's one of the main ways that attackers are getting malware installed on systems, right? So I want to ensure that I've got a strong email security solution in place. And, you know, most email providers are going to have security by default. You know, Google is going to have some basic filtering and maybe a few advanced things, Microsoft the same, right? But, you know, I want to invest in technologies that are going to be scanning my emails for malicious links and scanning those emails for malicious attachments, right? So it's, you got to go a little bit above what just the default offerings are going to be from your email provider. So email security is number one.
Yeah.
Number two is endpoint security, right? And so, you know, this is where we, everyone's always talking about EDR, endpoint detection and response. You know, the value there is that it brings better detection capabilities, better prevention capabilities, and when you need it, better response capabilities. So I always see that as just the blocking and tackling there. And then I look at users, right? And, yeah. And I think this is going to become more and more important in the long run as new companies spin up, that they're cloud native. And this is really about how do you protect the identity, right? So we gave this before, multi-factor authentication, right? Really making sure that you're protecting that user's access into systems. And there's a whole other slew of things with IAM that we don't need to get into, but just start with MFA, right? Super basic.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I always recommend is backups, and specifically secure and resilient backups. You know, when we look at the ransomware threat, it's not going away. I think everyone got a little bit of a breather last year because of everything that was happening in the world. And there was a decline in ransomware. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing now is that March had the highest number of ransomware incidents that were reported on the ransomware leak sites in the last 2 years. Right. Yeah. And so we're not, I'm not going to say ransomware is back, but like ransomware is back. Right. And so,
yeah.
Like we really need to make sure that, you know, you have good backups and we know it works too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when Corvus started mandating secure and resilient backups, we saw a 35% decrease in the number of victims who had to pay the ransom because they had backups, right?
Yeah.
And so this is just like, those things are the blocking and tackling of security. Get them in there and make sure they're configured properly.
Right. I think it's a great point, you know, on EDR, it's kind of funny because people throw an EDR in and then not watch the alerts, not do anything with the alerts. You're like, okay, you need to do that properly, actually. Or the one that always gets me, and I'm sure people are better at it now than they were a couple of years ago with, you know, everybody getting blasted with ransomware. But it's sort of what I would have considered to been a basic sysadmin task, like stuff that I would have, you know, been fired for 20 years ago, which is basically, no, I never test the backups. You know, you're like, what? You haven't tested your backups ever, you know, and then they don't work or they're not configured properly.
And how many times do you go into a situation where it's like, yeah, we got backups. And then, you know, you go and you fire them up and you're like, well, you haven't backed up your critical systems in, you know, 4 months. And like, oh yeah, we had an issue then. I thought we resolved that, but I guess we never got around to it.
Yeah. No, it's, that's definitely, The whole thing around backups is really can be one of those things where you're like, or it's configured in a way where it's hard to restore. Like nobody's thought of the fact where it's like, right, it's great for restoring, you know, somebody's folder that they deleted, but like your entire network's down. Have you prepared your backup, you know, strategy for that?
Well, and I think that's the key, right? Because when ransomware started shifting over into these enterprise style attacks, you go and ask somebody, do you have backups? Like, yeah, I got backups, right? And it's like the conversation typically goes one of a few ways. One is, well, we have another data center that everything's copied to, right? It's like, okay, well, is that data center connected to your main network? Yeah. And it's same Windows domain. It's like, okay, so when the attacker pushes out the ransomware, it's going to go to your backup site as well. So not really a good backup site. It's good from a physical disaster standpoint, right? And that's how it was built, but it's not ready to meet the demands of the cybersecurity side, right?
Right.
And so the other way it goes is, well, yeah, we have tape backups, right? It's like, okay, well, how long does it take you to restore those? Well, you know, with the critical system, the amount of data, it might take a couple of weeks. So it's like, okay, great. So like you've prepared for a catastrophic event, but you haven't thought through the next step of how do you keep your business running when that catastrophic event happens, right? And so this is where like we just have to shift our thinking. And I think this is why IT and security need to be so tightly commingled, because mm-hmm. you have to think about it in terms of not only from a usability standpoint, how do yeah. we keep the business running and, you know, make sure if somebody, you know, Sue in accounting accidentally deletes a file that you can get that back, but yeah. also how do we deal with the modern threats and make sure the business can continue to run when something like a ransomware incident occurs?
Yeah, I wonder if there's something there. You know, over the years, I think as cybersecurity has become its own thing, you know, it's become a distinct function. Like when I started it, for the most part, it wasn't. Like you might have, there was a very small number of people that were just doing cybersecurity. You know, I think back then it was more a part of what we did, just sort of running an IT infrastructure.
Yep.
So we had to know more things, but now as it's grown and they've separated, it's a great point that there can be this kind of conflict between the two, or separation, or, you know, because they're different functions, they're different backgrounds, you know, people even, it's crazy to me when, you know, and it makes me feel really old when people are like, oh yeah, I've got a degree in forensics or a degree in cybersecurity. Yeah. And they've been offering these for a long time now. There's a degree in that?
Yep.
Like they didn't have that when I was growing up.
But this thing, I mean, specialization is good, right? Yeah. But it does create silos in organizations, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes perfect sense, right? And like, this is not me calling out security. It's not me calling out IT, right? IT's job is to make the business more efficient.
Yeah.
Security's job is to reduce the risk. Mm-hmm. The problem is that when people get so heads down and they're only focused on that single objective, you get into extreme scenarios, right? Where, you know, security is known as the center of no, we can't do this, right? IT is the area of yes. Oh yeah, we can absolutely do this, right?
Right.
And so that's why, like, you really have to make sure that there's something there that can combine it together that says, how can we do this, understand the risk, and mitigate the risk? Because at the end of the day, a company needs to run. And we can't be in a situation where security is just coming in and saying, no, you can't do this because of this obscure edge case, and we got to protect against that. It's just not realistic, right? And that's, you know, I think partly that's the role of a CISO, is to help kind of figure out what that is. And that's why the CISO needs to be business focused, because your job is to reduce the risk while allowing the company to operate. And you got to play referee between the two. And I think, too, there's a trend happening where you have a lot of CISOs that are starting to own IT as well. Mm. And I think that might be the future here, is where it's just these things are going to merge, right? So it's almost like a CIO, CISO type thing. So we might be going back to where it started.
That would be, that'd be interesting, because I think the cultural differences, you've exactly nailed them. You know, it was strange for me, being, I considered myself an IT person who ended up in security. And just the cultural difference between the two, even, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where, as you said, one was like, oh, I like to build new shiny things, or cool, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to, you know, be innovative on doing these things. And then you move into security and it's like, you see bad things so often, you know, you're like, nope. Cause you know all the ways that goes wrong. And so having that balance between the two and then kind of both sides, I think, makes a big difference.
How did you make that switch? Because I think this is really interesting, where it's like you grew up in IT and then started taking on security. Like, what was it, your experience there? Like, was there a mental shift that had to happen?
I'm not sure I've ever made the mental shift, to be honest with you. Like, I struggle with it. And it's funny, the internal battles we have here. And it's like, oh, great, it's Anthony going off the rails, doing something else again. Like, you know, I think I'm really aware of the security side, but I've never sure I've adapted culturally. Like, it's always been hard for me. I'm like, oh, it's not that risky, it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
Now that I'm in a position where I'm a pretty good target, like, I have to be even more careful and I have to be even more secure. But at least I kind of understand, you know, I understand the risk pretty well and understand what's going on. But I would say culturally, I don't know that I've ever really properly adapted.
And I wonder if that is really just like you kind of get anchored to how you grew up, right? You know, this is not just your childhood, right? If we
take it's like early career psychology experiences. Here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, for me, right, I grew up professionally in incident response. Like, the way I work is so deeply rooted. Even though I don't identify as an incident responder anymore, thank God, because like it gives me a little bit more headspace, right? No offense to my DFIR friends, right? But like, a lot of what I do is based on it. And like, I remember for me, when I made that shift from IR to industry,
yeah,
it's a difficult transition because you really have to fundamentally shift how you think about it. Like just even just like a basic example is not everything is a fire.
Right.
And so it's like when you are always on and to your point where you're always seeing the worst of every situation, right?
Yeah.
You really have to step back and say, okay, what is practical for my organization or for me? Like you called out, right? That I'm more of a target now.
Yeah.
Amazing self-awareness, right? And so you have to adapt your kind of your procedures and how you would work because you are more of a profile than, you know, than what you were maybe 5 years ago, right? And
absolutely. Like,
that's the dynamic nature of security.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, I think one thing that's helped me is probably going back where I got started in all this. The reason I ended up in security in the first place is because if I wasn't properly securing the systems I was managing, we didn't have a security team. We didn't have firewalls. We didn't, you know, I was at a university. We were on the internet, like on the internet.
That's an even harder thing to try to secure.
My desktop was on the internet. Like I could go home and connect into an IP and that was my system. So if I, you know, like for me turning on the web, you know, installing a web server on my desktop, I had a website, I had my own domain, everything because it was, you know, there was absolutely zero things. I was in a university. I had my own IP and all this. So I had to really learn, you know, how to secure these systems. And I think people have kind of forgotten as well. It was pretty bad security wise 20 years ago. Like, you know, we kind of went through this transition and you know, there wasn't the economic, the sort of economy hadn't grown around us. So it wasn't the kind of ransomware economy or the, you know, the business email compromise economy to the extent there is now. Like, you know, obviously you had fraud emails and things like that, but the economy back then was probably mostly spam. You know, it was compromising systems to send spam was probably the most frequent thing. But you also had people just sort of messing around. And so you had these big systemic attacks, right? Like you had, you know, Code Red and you had NIMDA and, and you know, Anna Kournikova virus and all these things that were just spreading all over. And so you're like, right, if I don't do this right, I'm going to get blown up. Like my systems are going to be down. So you end up kind of having to learn it as a part of what you do day to day. But yeah, I wasn't specialized until later where I started working in a security operations center in a defense company.
Okay.
And that was where I was probably working all around security people and just focused on security at that point. And then I went into consulting and being a security consultant later on. Although I'll be really honest with people, I think the consulting part to me was always a lot more interesting than the security side of it.
Okay. In what sense?
I like just the sort of generic entrepreneurial generic advisory work, like just, you know, helping people kind of solve problems. And then the entrepreneurial nature of consulting was always really fascinating to me. Like, you know, one of my master's degrees was an MBA and I got that so I could learn more about the kind of entrepreneurial side of things.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's a lot of arguments, whether that's a waste of time or, you know, oh, just go start a business or whatever, but I found it valuable, you know, and I found it interesting to get sort of that entrepreneurial experience. So when I went into consulting, I saw it as an opportunity to build a business in an interesting area.
Mm.
And that was actually how I ended up in cyber insurance in the first place.
Interesting.
I was working, so years and years ago, I was working with an insurer here in London, and we handled all of their incident response and some of their proactive assessments as well. So it was kind of, you know, like, you could say outside in scanning, I guess. It wasn't quite to the point that it's developed today. But we would do that. We would do sort of assessments, like get on the phone with clients and kind of talk through, you know, doing that kind of, you know, are you doing this? Are you doing that? But the part to me that was always fascinating was building these different tools and services and then just taking it to market, going out, talking with people around. And then I found cyber insurance and I thought, wow, this is kind of a ridiculous idea. I was like, this is never going to fly. Nobody wants this. And then about 2 minutes later, I thought, this is the smartest thing I've ever seen. Of course, this makes sense. But at first, it didn't make any sense at all to me. I thought, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, 10 years later, it's obviously a lot different. But yeah, that was kind of how my my career path went.
Well, it's interesting with the consulting side, because you know, I started in consulting, and I would not change that for the world. And for a few reasons. One, it gave me a very practical understanding of security, right? And I went to school at a time where I got a degree. I tell people it was a security degree, but it was networking, security, and systems administration. So it was equal parts networking, equal parts security. But this was like, this was probably like 3 or 4 years before like the specialized forensics degrees were coming up, right? And I didn't even know what incident response was when I started it. So what I really found though was that, you know, understanding how attacks happen, that's the practical side of it, right? And that's where like you can really start seeing through a lot of the fluff that, you know, some of the frameworks give, right? And I think I used to hate frameworks, like you know, a lot of the security frameworks 10 years ago. Now I've come around to them because I do see the value that they bring to organizations that don't have that practical experience, right? But I think this is the overall challenge in security, is that there are so many things you have to do if you didn't grow up in the practical side of it, where like you are seeing attacks all the time.
Yeah.
How do you know what to prioritize? Right. Yeah. And so it's like, I was having a conversation with another CISO a few weeks ago, and they were telling me how some of the experiences they were having with their audit committee. And their audit committee was pushing on this one particular issue with printers. And it's like, that was the most important thing, you know, a potential security issue, which wasn't even a security issue, with a printer. And it's like, we have 5,000 things we can do.
Yes.
This printer is probably like 4,937 on that list compared to all the other things we have to do, right? But like, it's really difficult for security people to really understand that, especially when they're coming up from an academic standpoint, where it's just like you're taught, here's the NIST, you know, CSF framework, here's whatever, right? Like, it's really difficult to understand what's important. And I think that is the key thing in security, is you have got to understand the most important thing.
So, it's a really interesting point. I guess it's one of the things I really liked about insurance as well. I think insurance is great. Like you mentioned earlier, here's kind of the key things that you really need to focus on doing. I think insurance is great at kind of boiling it down to maybe a small number of things to really be worried about. It's kind of like it's risk focused, but it's not risk focused in the sense where it's like a massive framework you need to go and understand. It's not some giant risk framework that's complicated intellectually.
Exactly.
It's like, no, here's the insurance claims. Here's the top five insurance claims. Here's the top 10.
And that's the power of insurance, right? And so like, this is, you know, I get into fist fights with other CISOs all the time because they tend to hate insurance, because insurance is, you know, having you fill out all these applications and things like that. And they see premiums going up, right? But that's the issue, is that you know, I've got some people who come to me and say, you know, we've solved cybersecurity risk assessment. We have all of these, you know, different things. It's like, in what world are you going to have like Joe's Pizza Shack go and fill out, you know, a 50-page questionnaire to see if they're NIST compliant, right? Like, that's just not practical. So it really comes down to what you said. It's, how do you take this the complexity of cybersecurity and boil it down to five controls? I'm making up that number, right? But it's like the key controls that we know are going to have a material impact on the frequency and the severity of security incidents.
Right.
And that, like, that's how we get down to EDR, MFA, backups, right? Like, those are the things we just know works because of the data we see and all the issues that we, you know, security incidents that we have visibility into.
So kind of bringing on, going along that point then, you know, how could, I feel like insurance has a lot to add to organizations, you know, but they're often not very good at taking advantage of the knowledge or taking advantage of the tools or whatever it is that the insurers are offering. Like, how could they be better at it? How could insurers be better at getting them to adopt? But how could companies be better at adopting as well?
So, yeah, two different personas here, right?
Yeah.
You know, for the organization that's buying insurance, you know, step one is acknowledge that insurance is not the enemy, right? Like, there's almost no other company that you're going to work with as a business that has as vested an interest in you not having a security incident, right? Like, let's compare this to your EDR provider, right? I love all the EDR providers out there, right? But if they miss something, it's not the end of the world. Like, most companies still keep that EDR tool if something was missed. It's like, oh, okay, well, you know, yeah, it was a new malware strain, whatever, right?
Yeah.
With insurance, right? When you have an attack, which you don't want to have, insurance companies are losing as well, right? And that's why they pay so close attention to it. And so you have this partner available to you, right? They're not the enemy. They're not here to just try to jack up your rates, right? Like we want insurance carriers, when I say this collectively, we want to give you all of the information and resources to succeed, right? Yeah. And that is like the true partnership. So I think that's number one with you know, somebody who's buying insurance. Number two is understand what you have available to you, right? Yeah. And this is where insurance carriers can do a better job of this, of like better articulating all the services they have and better prioritizing it, right? And bridge that gap, right? And I think the broker plays a really good role in this to help articulate the value that insurance has, the different services that are available, get that over to the policyholder. But you know, for the policyholder, look at it not as something the insurance carrier is trying to push down. Look at it as free offerings, right? Or you know, significantly discounted offerings. You could probably run, you know, I'm going to make this number up, right? But like if I were to quantify all of the different services and offerings that, you know, Corvus would provide to a policyholder, like you can knock off maybe 10% of your security budget just with the resources that are available to you there for free, right? So it's just like it's a mindset shift.
Yeah, definitely on the side of the insured, you know, they don't always appreciate, probably because they, you know, on some level, it's like, oh, it's free or I haven't selected it. It is true that there's, you know, there's sort of financial limitations, right? If something is really expensive, obviously, you're not going to get it for free with your insurance. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact is the insurance company knows pretty well what's going to make a difference on claims. By these days, like, I think the risk management solutions are pretty valuable.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I can tell you for a fact, because of the data that we have, that if you are using an insecure email security gateway, you're 2.5 times more likely to have a BEC. That's just that's the data talking, right? And when you overlay that with the security expertise, right, makes sense, because we know that better email security is going to help mitigate some of the flood of emails that you're getting there, phishing emails. So, like, that's where it's just like, I feel like insurance is so uniquely positioned there because they have the data. And I like arguably there's like, if anyone has ever met an actuary before, like that, like your mind is going to be blown about how they can use numbers to articulate risk. Right.
Right.
And when you bring in that security expertise and like you're looking at large data sets, like that's the magic. Right. And that's where you can really take a step forward into quantifying, like truly quantifying the actual cost, not like the Verizon DFIR report where it's like all these attacks, the average attack cost is like $14 million. I don't know what it is. I stopped reading them because it just got so absurd. Right. But like that's the problem today is that like there's all these reports spouting bad information. And you've got like the insurance carriers here are sitting on the mountain of data here and just starting to kind of tease out some of the insights they have. And all it takes for, as you know, as a customer of insurance is to ask the question, right?
Right.
And then like you have all this information available to you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So I guess what, you know, we've kind of gone around this quite a bit. So there may not be more you could add, but is there anything you've seen insurers implement that really are making a difference to cyber risk management? Like what are some specifics?
Yeah, I mean, it's what we covered before, right? You know, backups, the better backups you have, the more resilient they are, the more secure they are.
How are they getting them to get the clients to adopt it?
So this is the beauty of the insurance industry, right? It's required controls.
Okay, so it's the underwriting side.
Exactly. It's the underwriting side, right? You know, we'll go back to the car analogies before, right? Seatbelts became a thing because insurance carriers are like, there's a lot of people dying in car accidents. And this like little piece of fabric here can stop people from dying, right? Like that's a good thing. Let's push to get that, you know, required to wear your seatbelt. It's the same thing for cybersecurity, right? You know, that's why we see MFA requirements. That's why we see EDR requirements. You know, my concern right now is where you have some carriers that are starting to pull these things back, these controls back, because we're in a soft market right now, right? Yeah. And so people are competing more on price. People are competing more on, you know, how do we just get more market share, right? And so there's the danger, right? Like flashback to 2018, 2019, where there was just, you know, carriers that are just trying to get as much market share as possible and not really fully understanding the threats. Like when you have declining controls and you have velocity of ransomware increasing again, right? Like we might want to start preparing for, you know, there another tough year or two in insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, I understand. I've put some thought into it, at least, why it's slow. It's slow for rates to go up, and it's slow for kind of underwriting to harden, you know, for people to get more difficult. And so, it, you know, it probably took, what, 2 years, really, for the industry to respond, probably maybe even longer. Like, I think early 19, this was already pretty obviously a big problem.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they finally respond, and then it drops off for 9 months or whatever. And it's like, whoop, party's back on. You're like, whoa, slow down. It's only been, you know, because now we're seeing, as you said, you know, it's busy. Like I think, you know, you see all the, I don't know, we'll see who's listening this far in all the, I'll throw some controversy out there. All the companies doing layoffs, all the deeper companies doing layoffs. And, all of a sudden, whoop, there it goes right back up again, just in time to not have a great level of capacity. Just like we were struggling 3 years ago and we just couldn't get enough people that were qualified to help. It's, you know, we're going to go back to that if people aren't careful.
Well, and, you know, what's going to happen now with the defer firms, right? And, you know, for anyone who's on the insurance side listening, right? Like, here's the warning, right? Yeah. It is hard to build quality defer experts.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I'll say this as a defer insider, right? Like, when you see DeFi companies try to scale, their quality 100% goes down.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't scale talent that quickly. And so what we're going to see is you had a lot of people leaving IR, you know, good people. And once you get a taste of what the real world is like, where you're not on call 24/7, it's difficult to go back, saying that from experience.
Right.
And so you're going to have to train people up. You're probably going to start seeing companies try to swipe from other companies. Yeah. And like, it's just going to become this rat race again. And the people that suffer the most are the clients, right? Yes. Like their experience goes down because they have less quality. You have, you know, less quality, and, you know, maybe it's longer investigations. Maybe it's just, you know, mistakes happen.
Absolutely. Well, it's really an interesting one. You know, the issues around scaling, the issues around finding talent. Those are problems, but as well, like literally just the issue of this company was 50 people. Now it's 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's going to be run differently, but there's not enough time. Like you're just throwing all these people into a big, you know, big pit. And it's like, all right, oh, we have no processes. We don't know how to route things. We don't know how to manage things. There's no stuff in the back end kind of built up. And so things just go to chaos.
Exactly. You know, it's, you know, running a successful DeFi firm, I truly believe this, and probably people get pissed off of this, right? But like, it's not hard, but it does take work, right? Yeah. Very simple recipe, but you got to do it in order, and you got to do it, you know, methodically.
Yes.
And when you scale from 50 to 250 people, all that discipline goes away. And that's when you start seeing these cracks start to show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I think the sort of 19, 20, maybe 21, like, I don't know it'll ever be that bad again, because I think there's much bigger awareness across the world.
Yeah. Better controls in place.
Better controls, you know, more resilient companies, et cetera. I probably won't go back to that. But I do think that we're going to be in for a bumpy ride if it really keeps, you know, this intensity.
Yeah. And, you know, for the insurance carriers, right? It's you gotta, it goes back to discipline, right? Just like the defer firms, right? Maintain that discipline because, you know, with Corvus, right? Like we see the massive uptick in March with ransomware.
Right.
And, you know, to the point, I think it was like 170% higher in this year than it was 2 years ago.
Okay.
You know, 60% bump from February to March. So like the velocity is coming back.
Yeah.
But for the carriers, right? Like you look at the Corvus side, we're not seeing the same type of increase in claims, right? And it's because we kept that underwriting discipline there. Right? It's like, you know, it's almost like playing a game of chicken with the market, right? It's like, who's going to let off first, right? Are you going to just cave for low prices, or are you going to kind of maintain and kind of take the longer term view of it, right? And like, again, it's all, everything in life is balanced, right? It's not an either or, right? But it's like, try to maintain that, because otherwise we're going to find ourselves in a very difficult situation again, where, you know, people are going to get caught and, right. You know, they're not going to be in a good position as a result of that.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Well, I can say we've definitely seen the uptick, I think, especially, you know, this is always a busy time of year anyways with W-2 fraud in the US, and
yeah,
you know, that really picks up. But definitely the ransomware has really started to come in again, and it's challenging and intense to manage those, and they tend to be bigger. It is better than it was. You know, the companies aren't down to the extent. So I think BI will be better.
Yep.
But yeah, it is. There's definitely a volume happening. So yeah, I guess kind of, you know, looking at shifts in or changes in volume, you know, what are you seeing in terms of changes in technique of these attackers? You know, what is that?
Yeah. Like? So ransomware actors have their playbook down, right? You know, we saw the shift to where they're doing double extortion. So we're seeing an increase in the number of engagements where ransomware attacks where you got data theft and you have the encryption. So I think that trend is here. It's solidified, not going away anytime soon. The thing that concerns me the most, though, is I think we're at the early precipice of MFA bypass. Right. And there's a few things that concern me the most. One is it's possible, right? So like there are proven methodologies and proven ways to bypass weaker forms of MFA. So, you know, specifically anything that's token based or anything that is, you know, on your phone.
Yeah.
And that's scary in of itself, but that alone is not the end of the world. But when you mix this together with different phishing kits, so these are like the kits that you can buy on the dark web to conduct a phishing attack. And these newer phishing kits include the ability to bypass MFA in there, right? Yeah. And so a couple different techniques. One of them is just, you know, adversary in the middle where they'll get you to go to a website that they control and then just intercept the token that you're sending over and your credentials and everything. And then you have MFA prompt bombing, where it's basically logging in, you steal a username and password, and then you just continually try to log in and prompt on that user's phone to get them to just click the button because they get frustrated with it, right? You mix in some social engineering, you know, call up the user because and pretend to be an IT person and have them click through. Like all this stuff is happening. You look at the last year and a lot of the major tech breaches that happened, mainly tied to the Lapsus group, it was all using that very basic technique, right? And so you have threat actors adopting this, you have toolkits that are there, and you have the proven methodologies to do this. And we're starting to see a small number of claims where this technique is being used, right? Still early days, because there's still plenty of people who, for whatever reason, haven't adopted MFA, right? But like, this is the early warning sign, right? Like in 2 to 3 years' time, even people who have adopted weaker forms of MFA, it's not going to matter because there's going to be these techniques to do it. And so, you know, I don't think we're ready as a market yet to push strong forms of MFA. So FIDO2 key. But I think, you know, in 2 to 3 years' time, we're going to be asking different questions on MFA. It's not, do you use MFA? It's, are you using phishing resistant MFA?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, no, we have seen exactly what you're talking about, which is, the vast majority of the things we get are not MFA bypass. They're just, you know, MFA wasn't enabled on a specific account, or because a lot of people think they've done it and they've done it for 80% of the accounts. And we missed that one.
Yep.
Or, you know, they didn't do MFA at all and have no idea. Although I would say the ones that have no idea are probably fading a bit. It's more like, oh, we haven't done it yet, but we're going to do it, or we meant to do it, or whatever. So at least it's not where it was a few years ago. I was like, what?
Yeah.
What's MFA? But once it's not so easy to get everyone else who's, you know, like everybody's kind of moved over to some form of MFA, then the next kind of low hanging fruit's going to be not very good MFA or not very secure.
Exactly. MFA. Yeah. The security bar always changes, right? You know, what's going to be that new norm? Because attackers are changing their techniques. Once they find that low hanging fruit is, you know, a little bit slim there, they're just going to go to that next layer.
They're incentivized to make their money for sure.
Exactly.
Well, cool. I like to kind of close out with a few other questions, maybe about, you know, some of your advice, some things, some of your opinions, maybe outside of, you know, maybe the technical stuff we've been talking about. So the first question I wanted to ask, you know, in terms of your background and in your career, like what qualities or skills do you think have been the most, you know, useful for you?
So for me, it's been around communication, right? Okay. I've always had a good technical understanding of things, but I also had the self-awareness to recognize that like I'm not going to be that hardcore technical person, right? And I realized that early on in my career, literally when I was trying to learn reverse engineering, where you know, you rip malware apart, and I was like, I literally physically looked to my right, and I was like, that guy over there is the best person I've ever seen doing this, and I know I'm never going to get to that level because I don't care enough about it.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know what? The things that I am good at, the things that I'm really, really good at are managing engagements and managing clients, right? Yeah. And the skill set there was really around, you know, having good project management skills. It was around being able to articulate in the same conversation, speaking to a CEO and then speaking to the head of security or the head of IT and being able to switch back and forth. So, you know, that ability to be able to bridge the gap between the business and the technical side, that has been the single-handedly the greatest skill that I've been able to develop. And the thing that has, I personally feel has allowed me to get to where I am today.
Okay. So I think the management skills, communications, communication, PM. Yeah, it's an interesting one on the tech side, you know, when it's, you know, kind of it's not that dissimilar to myself where, I compared to the average person, I'm pretty technical, but I could work with people that I could see. It's not just that you see them in there a little bit better than you. You see them and it's like, wow, they're at least 20 times faster, better quality. Like the gap is so big between the very best technical people.
Yep.
You know,
and that's not to say you can't get there, right? Because I fundamentally believe that anyone can learn whatever they
really
want.
Work at it. Yeah.
But it's, you know what, like it probably would have taken me 10 years to get to that level. And I was like, that is not where I want to be in 10 years. Right. And it's just like you can bob and weave through this. Right. But like, it's really, I would rather play to my strengths and get really good there and be more of a generalist in the tech world versus just being a heads down, super focused, like really, really good at this one thing. Like that wasn't for me, but it is for others. And that's great. Like, let them go down that route. I'm going to choose a different path.
Yeah, that makes sense. So kind of speaking about, you know, career history, how did you originally end up in insurance?
So it was primarily by accident. I think that's most of my career is just kind of fumbling my way through things. Yeah. But, you know, it's really when I started in incident response, this goes back to right when I was out of college. I was always working with incident response shops or DFIR shops that had relationships with insurance. So I was the service provider doing incident response. And so, you know, the entire time doing incident response work, that was it. I was riding, you know, the insurance wave. And then what I recognized, and this is why I got frustrated with incident response, was it felt like I was playing Mad Libs. Like I could go onto a scoping call and, you know, within 10 minutes, get the background and just know exactly what happened in the environment. Like I'm talking like a 90% plus success rate where I could tell them on the phone how it probably happened and be right. Yeah. And so for me, like, I'm like, why am I trying to solve security one client at a time? Right. Yeah. And when I looked at insurance and I saw, hey, they can require certain controls, I was like, this is it. You know, this is how you try to solve security at scale. And that's when I said, you know what, I need to step into the insurance role and really help influence here, because I think I can have more of an impact on more organizations if I can push better security controls through insurance versus try to solve it from a reactive standpoint.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It is interesting, the repeating aspect of it. You know, that was something pretty early in my career I'd see as well. And you get really good at it, right? Because you're like, this is the same thing over and over and over again. And people don't, there's probably some really interesting, like you mentioned the actuaries earlier, there's probably some really interesting statistical distribution or whatever in every case. And, you know, it's like, yep, it's that one again. And it's always, and it seems like if it's something technical, no matter what it is, there's always like, it's 99% of the time the same two things. Three things.
Exactly.
It is.
And that's why, like, most of these attacks are not sophisticated. Yeah. There certainly are some of those, right? And you can chase those, you know, if you're working at some of the bigger companies like a Mandiant or a CrowdStrike. But the vast majority, basic playbook, because it works.
Right. You do it over and over again, and, you know, the attackers are making their money.
Exactly.
So cool. Well, I one more question. Two more questions. First question, what is your favorite part of being in insurance?
So I'll modify the question slightly and call it to insure tech because, you know, that's what really excites me is, you know, how can you bring technology to bear to better quantify and understand risk? Yeah. That to me is really exciting. And, you know, at the same time, you know, it goes to what I talked about before, right? It's having a positive impact on clients, right?
Yeah.
That's what I loved about consulting. You're really close to the problem and helping somebody get more secure. Yeah. I just see insurance as a more efficient vehicle to do the same and do it before they experience pain. Like no company should ever have to go through an incident response exercise where they need to bring in somebody on the outside, because that's usually like a very, very bad day for them, right?
Yeah.
If I can avoid companies having to do that, that's a good day. And I think insurance is well poised to help, you know, get that closer to a low number.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And now finally, the last question, what do you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in insurance or so insure tech or you can go any of those.
So, I think, you know, with cyber insurance in particular, right? It's understanding the threats. It goes back to what I mentioned before. You know, you have to have a practical understanding on how these threats work. You know, how does an attacker get into an environment? How do they move around? If you can understand the basics there and just, you know, understand those playbooks that these attackers use, I think that's going to really separate you out, right? And I think that's what a lot of insurance professionals have struggled with just over the last 10 years is really trying to get that. And, you know, I think we're a lot better than we were before, right? But you know, now I'm just seeing more of like that. You know, again, don't need to be a tech expert, right? But understand the fundamentals. And I always tell people, be able to go, you know, 2 to 3 questions deep, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you're having a conversation, you should be able to comfortably answer, you know, 2 to 3 follow-up questions. You know, two is usually the safe spot. And then that's okay. You know, once you get beyond, you know, 3 questions, typically you're getting into like more of an expert level conversation.
Right.
But if you can go 2 levels deep in questions, I think you're going to be well poised to do very well in the insurance space.
Yeah, no, that's it's a great point. I think it's the same even on the tech side, where people who maybe are not necessarily in a very technical role will often avoid any sort of tech anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a huge difference between needing to have a level of being a system administrator or a penetration tester versus knowing kind of what's going on or how to talk about those things or how the attacks work or, you know, how a system works, like the basics of an operating system, that sort of thing. I think everybody should have that sort of baseline knowledge.
Exactly. It's a hobbyist level, right? Yeah, like you don't need to do it full time, but just reach that hobbyist level. And I think that you separate yourself from the pack with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, perfect. Well, that is our show. Thanks a lot, Jason, for coming. And it was a real pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.